Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Bava Metzia Daf Kuf Hey. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a specially marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage and then go to option 2. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked daf before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur will begin at the Mishnah that you will find at toward the end of the narrow lines of the Gemara, 15 lines from the top. The Mishnah, Hamekabel Soda Mechaveroi, one who accepts to work, to cultivate someone's field, Velo Rotso Lenachish, and the worker doesn't want to weed the field. We spoke about weeding in previous dapim, and we indicated that if the practice was to weed, so the expectation is that the worker will weed it. In this case, the worker says, I don't want to weed it. V'omar lo, and he further explains to the owner, ma ichpas loch, what difference does it make to you whether I weed it or not? Hoyu vani noisein loch es chakircha. I am going to be giving you anyway a fixed amount as per our agreement, a fixed amount of grain, whether I weed your field or not. Rashi points out, in light of the Gemara we saw back on Daf Kuf Dalid, that some of the Mishnayos are relevant to a sharecropper, to an Oris, and some are relevant to a Chocher, an agreement that the worker pays the owner a fixed amount regardless of the harvest. So this Mishnah has no relevance to a sharecropper where the division of produce is based on a percentage of the field's yield. In such a case, you would never hear a worker saying to the owner, what difference does it make whether I do this or not? It makes a difference because the owner's income is based on the percentage of yield of that particular field. But in a case of a chocher, where the agreement is, regardless of what the field produces, the chocher, the worker, will pays the owner a predetermined fixed amount, there is room for him to argue, what difference does it make whether I weed the field or not? I'm giving you a fixed amount of income anyway. Nevertheless, ein shoymen lo. We do not accept what the worker is saying. He must weed the field. Mipnei shiyocho lo malo, because the owner has a claim, a response to the worker, saying, "Lamocharato yotze, tomorrow you're going to leave the field. Lamocharato yotze mimeno, you're going to be leaving the field. Umales lefanei asofim, you'll be leaving with a field that as a result of your non-weeding will produce undesirable grasses." The Gemara. And as you scan ahead in the Gemara, you notice a triangle, one of our series markings. And under our Nosei/Mivneh heading, the Nosei is the topic heading, Mivneh, a structural note. In this case, we combine the two. And it reads, Ta'anois she'achoycher menase litoin. We introduce various claims that the worker will try to argue, Kedei shelo lenachish, in order to avoid weeding the field, avol kol echod nidche, but each one of these claims will be rejected. The Gemara. E omar le, if the worker says to the owner, listen, I don't want to weed the field. However, lebosser hachi kariv nola, but after I harvest the field, I will plow it up. Rashi, at the end of the narrow line, says Vi Omale Karivna Bukhule Hashta Meforesh. Here the Gemara will explain, Amai Ein Shomin Lo, why do we not listen to the worker's claim or desire not to weed? If the worker tries to say, listen, I'm going to plow up the field after the harvest, turn over the soil, revealing the roots of the whatever grasses remain there, i.e. those grasses that I didn't weed out, I'll be turning over their roots, and as a result of that, your fear of bad grasses, undesirable grasses growing forth will not come to reality. My mahadale, so then what would the owner react, respond to that? So now we turn back to the Gemara. After hearing what the worker might claim, listen, I'm going to plow up the field anyway after the harvest, which would, in his mind, get rid of whatever undesirable grasses that the owner was concerned about. Omarle, the owner, will respond, I want you to weed the field. Chiti malya sabina, I want good quality wheat. In other words, and we didn't explain this before, but we did explain this in a previous year, the weeding would have taken place before the harvesting of the grains, so that while the grains are growing, I want you to weed it so that I get good quality grains. And Rashi adds, in the owner's desire for good quality grains, he's really saying, listen, you know, we agreed upon a fixed amount, that's a fixed quantity that you, the worker, would pay me. Well, I want that fixed amount to be good quality and not dried out type grains. The Gemara continues. Ve'i omalei, and if the worker would counter that and say, Zavinino loch chiti mishuka, what are you worried about? You want good quality grains? I will buy from the market good quality grains. And of course, once again, all of this is so that the worker would avoid having to weed out the field. Amalei, but nevertheless, the owner responds, Chiti da roi boina, I want grains growing from my field. People have an affinity toward that which their own property produces, and hence the owner argues that in response. Vi amalei, man kishna loch shir monasech. Okay, he says, I will weed out the amount that is due to you as monasech, your portion. In other words, the owner has a pre-agreed upon amount that the worker is going to pay him. So the worker says, so I'll weed that that part of the field that will yield the portion that I owe you. In other words, again, the worker is trying to avoid having to weed the entire field. So could this not be an argument back to the owner? Amale, owner can nevertheless say in return, Ka mansivis shem ra la roi. You're leaving according a bad name to my field. In other words, by not weeding the field, people see a field with weeds growing in it. Regardless of the fact that you'll weed a small portion of it that will yield my share, but nevertheless, the rest of the field will have the weeds growing in it, and it'll create a bad name for my property. So, at this point, that would appear to be the owner's true or final response to the worker in his insistence on the worker's weeding the field. The Gemara asks, V'hotnan, but that's not the reason the Mishnah gave. The Mishnah said, "B'nei shemalas l'fonei asovim." The owner's concern is because the field will, if it's not weeded, it will produce it'll produce weeds. Let us take a look at the Rashi on the third line under the Gemara text. V'hotnan, harei. Lo shona b'masnisin, the Mishnah doesn't teach elo taino achas. It teaches only one claim, u'bishvilo komar, and because of that one claim that the Mishnah teaches ain't shomen lo. Al korchuk b'hot tal yekula. It's because of the claim presented in the Mishnah that the owner's argument rests. And in the Mishnah, no mention was made of a bad name given to the field. Elo, so now, we turn back to the Gemara. Elo, Mishum di Omale, the owner's response to the worker, in fact, is Bizra seeds. Bizra de nofal nofal. And we look again back at Rashi. Elo mishum de omar le Bizra de nofal nofal. Kol tanoso, the whole claim of the owner against the worker in owner's insistence upon workers weeding, eino elo shemalas asovim l'shana bo. It's only because next year, if you don't weed now, next year bad, or next year weeds will appear. Asovim, literally, or grasses, we in English might refer to them as weeds will appear. V'tanoso li'oilom oimedes. And this claim is a permanent, ongoing claim. That even in the event that the worker says, I will plow up the field after the harvest, the owner will respond, granted, you're uprooting the roots of the current weeds, ad shiyizru yiplu hazroim la'aretz, the weeds that you are leaving there will produce seed. Seeds of weed seeds will fall. V'yitzvul shanabo v'lezu lo soil harisha, and the plowing doesn't work to prevent that from happening. The plowing uproots existing weeds, but those existing weeds, though they're uprooted and turned over, the seeds that they contain will nevertheless take root and emerge as weed plants next year, so that the worker's attempt to avoid weeding with his offer of plowing is not going to solve this problem, namely the appearance of weeds as a result of seeds falling now and growing into weeds in the upcoming season. The Mishnah. We have a topic heading that reads under the Nosei on the side in our margin, Shiur Tvua Shemoitzi Sadeh, an amount of wheat, of grains that a field produces, Shepachos Menu Chocher Eino Chayev L'Tapel B'Sadeh, that if it were produced less than that, then there is no expectation of the worker to cultivate the field. So we're talking about a minimum amount of produce that is expected to grow to justify a worker's investing efforts in cultivating it. Before going into the text itself, once again, Rashi, as he said in our previous, we saw this in our previous shiurim, Rashi said he will point out as each Mishnah arises, is it relevant to a chocher, or is it relevant to an oris? And here, this Mishnah has relevance only to the case of the kablonis or oris case, where the issue is a percentage of harvest that is given to or split between worker and owner. In the case of chachronis, that chocher relationship, the worker provides an objective amount of produce, whether from this field or he buys it from some outside source, as we just saw in our previous discussion. Therefore, the issue of how much this field will produce to justify his work on it is not relevant to the case of a chocher. Now the Mishnah. Hamekabel soda mechavero, one who receives a field from an owner to cultivate it, velo osa, and it doesn't produce. Im yesh bo kedei leharmid kri chayav letapel ba. And here we're going to simply translate, leaving the explanation to the Gemara. The translation is, if there is enough in the field to produce a kri as a pile of grain, so then he has to work the field. Omar v'yuda, my kitzva b'kri. What kind of quantity is that? When you talk about enough grain to produce a pile, in saying that, you're not regarding the size of the field. Is it a field that measures a quarter of an acre, or a field that measures the equivalent of a Texas ranch that's from thousands of acres. So what kitzvah, what amount, what fixed amount is there in saying a kri? Elo im yesh bo kedei nefila. Rather, Rabbi Yehuda says, if the field produces enough grain, which we say enough seed, in order to replant that field in anticipation of next year's growth, that is enough. So, of course, that amount will vary from field to field. Small field doesn't need too much to be produced in order to plant it, to replant it. A large field naturally will need more in order to replant it. Now the Gemara. Tanu Rabbanan, Hamakabel Soda Mechavero V'Lo'asa, person accepts to work upon a field and lo and behold it doesn't produce. Im Yesh Bo Kedei Lahamid Kri Chayav L'Tapel Bo. If it produces enough to create a pile of grain, so then the worker is obligated to cultivate it, to invest efforts in it. Shekach Kosev Lo, because thusly the worker agrees in his, let's see, in his written agreement. Ana oikim v'onir, and here we have a list of various agricultural operations or activities that the worker agrees to do. He says, I will arise v'onir, and plow v'ezra, and plant v'echtsod, and harvest v'emor, and gather together piles of sheaves of grain, v'odush, and thresh, the idri, and winnow, the oikim karya, and here we have the phrase that's let's say relevant to us, to our discussion, and I will set up a pile of grains after the threshing and winnowing, kadmoch, in front of you, v'teisi ant, v'teitol palgo, and you will come and take half, v'ano ba'amli v'nafkis yodi palganai, in exchange for my work and my efforts, also will receive half. That, of course, is characteristic of the Oris arrangement, where the division is on a percentage basis. V'kama kidei lahamid bakri, and here the Gemara asks, we saw in the Mishnah and also in this Brisa, reference to a pile of grain. Well, how much is that? What do you mean by enough to produce a pile? Omra b'yosi b'chino k'dei shetamod bo ha-rachas. It should be a sizable or significant pile enough that you could insert into the pile a rachas. A rachas is a utensil used for winnowing, whereby it has a long handle. I would imagine a standard type handle, like your many shovels or broom handles have. And on the bottom part, there is it's wide, and it might be something you would call like a pitchfork, where you insert the wide end under the the grain stalks, and through that you're able to do the winnowing process. Rashi says shezorin hamoitz beruach mitoch hatvua. So you need this vessel that has a wide end, and which enables you to slip it under the grains and toss them in the air. So we have this utensil. And the Gemara says, if the pile of grains is significant enough that you could jab your rachas in it, and the rachas will stand up, it will be supported by the pile of grains, then that is enough. The Gemara asks, Ibayaloh rachas hayotze mehai gisa oy mehai gisa mai. We're adopting the girsa that we found in the Tosfos. When you speak about a pile that's able to support this farm utensil, which end of the farm utensil? If it is a pile of grain if our requirement is that you would be able to wedge the wide part of this utensil in the pile of grain. You don't need that big a pile of grain. The utensil itself with the wide bottom to it enables even a smaller kind type pile to support the rachas utensil. However, so and we said in the Gemara, Mahai Gisa, which this side, this end, or that end, is it the wide end, and hence the pile required would be smaller, or is it the narrow, thin end, the handle, whereby you would stick the rachas in handle first, and expect the grain pile to support the rachas placed in handle first, that would require a more significant size pile in order to support the rachas. So that's the question. Which end of the rachas utensil are you speaking of when you speak about the pile supporting it? Shekadesha tamoy boyo rachas. A pile in order that the rachas vessel or a utensil can stand in it. Toshma omer Rabbi Avo. Rabbi Yehoshua tells us that it was explained to me by Rabbi Yehoshua. Kol she'ein kines shaloi roya pene hachama. The kines shalo would be the wide part of the rachas vessel, and his standard is. It would have to be a pile in which you would be able to insert the wide part of the rachas, the bottom of the rachas vessel, so that it doesn't see the sun, meaning it is inserted. But that would explain then wide part in the pile is enough and not the other way around, handle in first. Itmar, Levi Omar, Sholosh So'in. Debe Rabbi Yanai Amri Sosayim. The shitos that you see here are offering actual, we'll say, objective quantities of the pile. So Levi says the pile would have to be 3 saw, that's of course a measure, and the Bei Rabbi Yanai mentions sosayim, 2 sa'ah. Reish Lakish, in explaining the Bei Rabbi Yanai, says that the sosayim is chutz min hotzah, means after expenses. The marking that you see under the Bei Rabbi Yanai is explained on the side under the Mivneh heading, and you'll also note it's based on a comment made in Rashi. We highlight Hadgoshas, that's highlighting the Bei Rabbi Yanai, and we forward you to Rashi, Dibur HaSol Tanan Hasam. Agav Hoifu'osu Shel the Bei Rabbi Yanai Kan, since the mention of the Yeshiva Rabbi Yanai appears here, in terms of offering a quantity, a shiur, Muva oid makoros, we will see there are brought forth other sources, makoros or sources, which are highlighted with the diamond marking that you see. Shalehem, regarding these subsequent Tanaic sources, the Bei Rabbi Yanai meforshim shiurim, the Yeshiva Rabbi Yanai offers an explanation in terms of quantities that are relevant to these additional sources. So get a bird's eye view of the Gemara first. After the Debei Rabbi Yanai that we saw in our discussion about size of pile that justifies the continued efforts and work of the sharecropper, we have a Tanaic source which reads Pritzei Zeisim Vanovim, etc., and that's our number one in the diamond. And as you continue a few lines further in the Gemara, you'll notice a double underline highlighting once again the Bei Rabbi Yanai, where they too comment on the upcoming discussion following this Tanaic source of Pritzes Esim. The bottom line, you see a final, an additional diamond we call number two, and that introduces a Tanaic source that you find at the top of Amud Beis. And regarding that, also the Bei Rabbi Yannai make a comment that has that deals with size and quantity. And following that, you'll see a number three as well. And following the three, you'll see a comment made by the Bei Rabbi Yannai. And following that diamond number three, there is more that the Bei Rabbi Yannai has to say regarding other mitzvahs, tefillah and tefillin. You will see later. The theme, by way of markings, though, is the reference to the Bei Rabbi Yannai in their making comments that have to do with quantities. Beyond that, there's no connection between the different sources, and that is what Rashi himself points out. You can see this, and let's look at it together. Rashi, five lines from the bottom, five, six lines up from the bottom, says, Tanan Hosav v'Maseches Uksin v'chulei, a Tanaic source from the tractate of Uksin, which is, by the way, a tractate that doesn't have, it has no Gemara on it, but it's a tractate of Mishnayos. And in that tractate of Uksin, there is a Tanaic source brought, and the Rashi says, Mishum Amri de Rabbi Yannai, the Meforshi Shura, Bekulhu, Hanoch Masisin, because the Bei Rabbi Yannai comments regarding the quantities in all of these Tanaic sources, Nokat Luhu Gabi Masnisin, the Meforshi Ba, the Bei Rabbi Yannai Shura. They're brought in here so as to, we'll say, as a continuation, as an attachment to the Bei Rabbi Yannai here that makes a comment regarding pile of grain. This, by the way, is not uncommon in the Shas, that additional discussions and topics are brought forth that have no seeming relevance to the topic at hand, but you will find a name that appears in all the subsequent sources and discussions that the Gemara references, the same name that appeared in the topic that was relevant to the Gemara. Now the Gemara, Tanan Hosom, Pritze Zeisim Vanovim. The Gemara very shortly will ask, what are Pritze Zeisim? But in the meantime, we just read those words as they are. Beishamai Mitamin. Beishamai classifies them as food, and hence they are Mitama Oichlin. They have food defilement. Well, Beis Hillel, Mitam, Beis Hillel does not view them as food. He says, Pritzei Zeisim are not fit for eating. Hence, the laws that apply to food defilement are not relevant to Pritzei Zeisim. The Gemara asks, my Pritzei Zeisim, what is meant by that? Zeisim, of course, are olives. What are Pritzei Zeisim? Amar Rav Huna, Rishei Zeisim. Literally, evil olives. Evil olives mean olives that are very poor. They don't ever ripen. Omar Rav Yosef, my craw, what's the posuk in which you see pritze associated with that which is bad? So he offers a posuk, and we call it aleph because Rav Nachman, who appears very shortly, will offer a different source. The posuk that is offered here, Uvnei pritze amcha yinosu Lahamid Chazon v'nichshelu. In that pasuk, without translating the pasuk literally, you see pritze in the context of those that that stumble, that sin. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok Omar Mehocha. From this pasuk, you see the word poritz associated with that which is negative, that which is evil, and hence of bad quality. The pasuk says, "Vahodid ben Poritz shofech dom," and the the pasuk describes the birth of a ben poritz who will shed blood. So you see that poritz has to do with an evildoer. V'kamo pritzei zesim. In order to appreciate this, we look at Rashi. The Rashi, four lines from the very end. V'kamo pritzei kamo hein mevusholim v'adayin pritzin hein. What level of, say, of ripeness do they reach, and we would still refer to them as pritzin? Now, in dealing with olives, inevitably we will deal with olives in their capacity of producing olive oil. So, with that in mind, we continue. So, Rabbi Lozer, Omar Arbaas, Kavin Lekira. Four. Kav. Kav is a measure. In this case, it's a measure of oil. Korah is a reference to a heavy beam that is used during the olive pressing process. The Rashi, three lines from the bottom of the Rashi commentary, Arboaz Kav and Korah, Shemachnisin Bebeis Abad Mehen, Kedei Shi'ur, Te'ina Sakur Bepamachas. Olives would be still categorized as pritzizesim when you would put into the olive press, the base of is the olive press, an amount that justifies, we'll say, the weighing down of the korah, the heavy beam, in one shot. The ein motzien ela arbo kavin shemen. So there's a known quantity of olives that one ordinarily loads into an olive press. And once the olives are loaded into the olive press, a heavy beam is placed down upon them as part of the squeezing process. So pritzizesim would be such that you would load up fully load up the beis abad, justifying the weighing, the placing of the beam upon them. And lo and behold, all that would result from this full olive press worth of olives is a mere four kav of shemen. The olives like that would be called pritzei zesim. Debei Rabbi Yanai, naturally, you see their name highlighted with the double underline, Amri, they say, sosayim lekora, not four kav, but two saw. Now, two saw, if we translate that into kavim, one saw contains six kav. So two saw would be 12 kav of shemen, which you can see easily is three times the amount that Rabbi Lozer spoke of. Velo pligi, there's no argument between Rabbi Lozer and Debei Rabbi Yanai. Ha ba'asro demaili kora ba'ulala. Ha ba'asro demaili tlosa kurin ba'ulala. We didn't mention the quantity of olives that you initially load into the press. Here, the Gemara gets into that. It specifies what is meant by an olive press full of olives. We said for one pressing, how much is considered a full load of olives? So, in the community, the Asra, the town of Rabbi Lozer, a full load was one kur of olives, the ulala. Rashi says, "Betfucha achas shekor and sak." For our purposes, it's a reference to we'll call the full load of olives that you would put into the press at one time. And as far as Rabbi Lozer is concerned, that full load is one kur. And ha ba'asra d'mayli t'losa kurin b'ulala. In Rabbi Yanai's community, a full load would be three kurs. Notice three times as much. So that when the two opinions stated their olive oil quantities, naturally the Debei Rabbi Yanai, where more olives are loaded in initially, more oil would be expected to be produced. And hence you can see the 1-to-3 relationship between Rabbi Lozer and Debei Rabbi Yanai. But if on a prorated basis, they're essentially telling us the same thing. Tanu Rabbanan. We continue at the top of Amud Beis. A Tanaic source tells us a Zav and a Tohar. A Zav is a man that is defiled as a result of certain fluids. The Zav fluid emitted from his body makes him defiled. So a Zav and a Tohar, an undefiled individual, are both in a tree at the same time. What we're trying to discover here is the ability of the Zav, even without physical contact with the undefiled person, there is a possibility of the undefiled person becoming defiled. And this has to do with movement that one causes to the other. It doesn't matter if the Zav is causing the movement of the Tohar or the Tohar is causing the movement of the Zav. Either way, the Tohar would be defiled. Let me just say, let's say in contrast, imagine a Zav and a Tohar sitting together at the same time on a concrete park bench. The bench isn't going to move one iota by virtue of the Zav sitting on it at the same time as the Tohar. You would contrast that with a Zav and a Tohar sitting down on a large, let's say, porch swing. There, one is causing the movement of the other. And hence, defilement would set in on the Tohar person, on the undefiled person who's sitting on the swing at the same time as the Zav. Now, here we're going to be speaking about a tree. And the source says, Olu means they went up, the Zav and the Tohar together, Be'ilon Shekoyche Ra, up a tree that is whose strength was weak. U'besoicha, socha is a branch, Shekoyche Ra, Tome, the Tohar individual will become defiled. So we spoke, this source speaks in terms of a weak tree or a weak branch. Hechi domi ilon shekoyche ra. What do you mean by a tree that is weak? Amri de Rabbi Yanai, and well, of course, you see the double underline, and that's why this is here. The Beir Rabbi Yanai, the Yeshiva Rabbi Yanai explained, kol she'ein beikoro lachuk roiva. Any tree that its trunk, its ikar, its trunk, is not large enough to enable you to carve out of it a rova. A rova is a size. It's a, Rashi says you wouldn't be able to carve out of the width of this tree trunk the size of a rova kav, quarter of a kav, which is a measure. So it's a known quantity. If it's not wide enough for you to be able to carve out that quantity in its width, it is unfit, where it's considered a weak tree. Hechidomi seicha shekechara, what is meant by a weak branch? Amar Reish Lakish kol shenechbeis beachizyona. Rashi says beachizyona shenit menes, it's literally hidden, beachizosa, in your holding of it. Sheha oiches ba, if you were to grab in your hand the branch, tomno bekaf yodo, you would be able to surround your hand around the branch, that the branch is key, is as if it's hidden within your hand. That is considered a weak branch vis-a-vis our halacha concerning the ability of the Zav to communicate his tuma to the Torah person that's on the branch at the same time as the Zav. Tanan Hosam, Hamahalich Beveisa Pras, Al Gabi Avonim, Shiyochola Hasid. A Beisa Pras is a field in which there was a grave. However, the grave was plowed up. And the fear or the consideration in this case is that the plow blades dispersed bones from the corpse that was buried in that field, and the blades of the plow would have ground up the bones to small pieces, and a bone communicates tumah, human bones from a dead person, communicate tumah, communicate defilement, if they are a barley grain in size. You have a barley grain size piece of bone. A person who either touches it or supports it will become defiled. As opposed to an actual corpse, there's no overshadowing defilement that we call tumas oil when it comes to small pieces of bone. But an etzem kisaora, if you cause, if an undefiled person causes the movement, we speak about causing movement. Once again, we don't require for defilement to set in your actual touching the bone material. It's sufficient if you cause the movement of the bone material that tuma will be communicated. Now, in this source, you will see a case of a Torah person riding upon the shoulders of another individual. Does the person riding atop become defiled? Is he responsible for the possible movement of the etzem kisoira? So now the Mishnah says there, quoting a Mishnah from Maseches Oilus, Hamahalech beveis hapras al gabi avonem shiochol hasid. One is walking through a beis hapras, that's the field in which the grave was plowed up, and he's walking on stones that can be moved. And as we said, the fear is that the movement of the stones results in the movement of bones, that bone, small bone fragments that are beneath the surface. So now we get into greater detail, and we say, Al ha'adam, the al ha'beima shekoichen ra, tome, if someone is riding atop a person or an animal who are classified as weak, so the person riding atop will become defiled. How do you describe a person, the lower individual who's supporting someone atop him, that lower individual, who is he, or how do you describe him when you say he is weak? Omar Reish Lakish, Kol Shiroichoi, V'akavoisav Noichshois. Anyone who, as a result of someone sitting atop him, causes his knees to bang together. So he's not strong enough to be able to walk in a solid, straightforward fashion, but rather as a result of the weight upon him, his knees, the one who's carrying the person atop, his knees are banging one into the other as he's walking along. He's described as How do you describe an animal that you consider koichira, weak? Amri debe rav yanai. There you see your double underline again. Kol sheroichva matilo glolim. Any kind of animal that, as a result of riding atop it, it can't withhold its waist, and as a result of riding it, it casts forth its dung. As we continue in the Gemara, you see, of course, another double underline where Rav Yanai makes reference to two halachas, one concerning tefillah and one concerning tefillin. And in both cases, the same shiur applies, the shiur of four kav. And that's what we've highlighted on the side under our Mivneh heading, where the diamond appears, tefillah utefillin. Shtei halachas sheyesh ba nafkamina b'shiur dalet kav, and two halachas where there is a practical legal application when it comes to four kav. that probably sounds a bit vague, but of course, as we go on in the Gemara, it should become much clearer. Now the Gemara. Amri debei Rav Yanai. Litfilo lutfilin arba kavin. Litfilo mahi. What is meant by four kav with reference to Shmona Esrei? Tfilo's prayer, specifically Shmona Esrei. Desanya. Hanoise masui al ksefoi. Someone who's carrying a burden, a package upon his shoulders. Vehigia zman tfila, and time for Shmona Esrei has arrived. Pochos midalet kavin mafshil la'achirav umispalo. If the size of the package is less than four kav, he can sling the package over his back and daven and pray. In other words, a weight of a package less than four kav won't interfere with his ability to concentrate the necessary concentration for tefillah. Arba kavin, if the package measures four kav, meniach agabi karku mispalel, he has to place it on the ground and only then to start davening, to start his prayer. Litfilin mahi, what is the reference of four kav with regard to tefillin? Desanya hoyonase masui al rosho, who tefillin barosho. If a person were carrying something on his head, and at the same time he's also wearing tefillin, and tefillin, in addition to tefillin that one wears on his arm, one also wears tefillin on his head. Im hoyu tefillin roitzitzeis aser, if the tefillin would be crushed under the weight of the package, so it's forbidden. V'im lav, if it's a package that would not cause the crushing of the tefillin, mutter, then it would be allowed to have the individual, while wearing tefillin, carrying the burden. Be'ezim asu omru, regarding what kind of burden do we speak of when we say it can crush? The masui shel arboas kavin, a burden weighing four kav, a burden of four kav, is that which be capable of crushing the tefillin. Tani Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya teaches, once we have mentioned rules of tefillin and carrying things on your head at the same time, he says, Amotzi zevel al rosho tefillin barosho, one who carries out Zevel is translated often as fertilizer or garbage, something that is odoriferous, and he's carrying that on his head while tefillin are upon his head. Hareze lo yisalke mutzdodin v'leikshirei b'mosnov. One is not to push the tefillin off to the side, to distance the tefillin from the zevel that's on your head. In other words, that's not a solution to push them off to the side. V'lo yikshrei b'mosnav, nor is it a solution to take the tefillin off your head and tie them around your waist. Mipnei shunoyig ben minig bizayon, this would constitute a disgraceful form of behavior. So what should one do? Avol kishum alzro b'mokum tefillin, the tefillin shalosh are to be removed from his head and tied around his arm. On one's arm there is room for tefillin. There's obviously the tefillin shel yad that are always placed on one's arm, and next to the tefillin shel yad he will now attach the tefillin shalosh, the head tefillin. Mishum debei shilo amru, in the name of the yeshiva of Rabbi Shilo, they said, "Afilu mitpachas shalan also neach al rosh, sheyesh bo tefillin." Even the cloth in which one ordinarily wraps the tefillin. Rashi speaks in terms of people wrapping up their tefillin at night. They may very well have worn their tefillin all day, and at night they wrap them in a mitpachas. The Tosfos quotes the Rabbeinu Chananel, that has a different girsa, different version. For our purposes, though, we'll continue with the Rashi. So the Bay, Reb Shila says, even the tefillin cloth in which they are wrapped, Asu laniach al harosh sheyesh bo tefillin. It's forbidden to have that on your head while your head is, while you are wearing upon your head tefillin. V'kama, according to the Debei Shiloh, what size burden are we speaking of? Amar Abaye afilu riva, the riva de Pumbedisa. Even a quarter of the quarter weight of Pumbedisa would be, and if this is something that's very, very small, that would be a masui that, according to Be'er Shibu, would be forbidden to have on one's head. We have a new marking, a crown shape, and on the side, under our Mivneh heading, we indicate Beis Mekoros, the two sources, Shemuzker Behen, Shiur Kedei Nefila, in which that the quantity of Kedei Nefila appears. We saw that, of course, in the Mishnah, under Rabbi Yehuda's explanation of how, we'll say, what's the minimum amount a field is expected to yield in order to warrant the workers' continued efforts in cultivating it. So we saw that shiur, that quantity called kedei nefila. V'agemara tishal b'shnei amikrim kama kedei nefila. And in both cases, the Gemara will be asking the question, how much is kedei nefila? And that will be highlighted, the question will be highlighted with a double underline. So when you look into the Gemara and you do the bird's eye view, you'll see the two sources introduced with a crown shape, followed by the double underline where the question of kama kedei nefila appears. Now the Gemara, Amar Rav Yehuda, this is a quote from our Mishnah. My kitzva, what is the let's say minimum amount? My kitzva b'kri, he said, he reacted to the Tanakam, who said, then it's enough if the field produces a kri, a pile of grain, to require the worker to continue his efforts. He, Rav Yehuda, was opposed to that vague quantity. Ella, rather, Rav Yehuda said, im yesh bo kedei nefila, if there is enough in the field to fulfill the quantity of kedei nefila, then the worker is expected to continue cultivating that field. V'kama kedei nefila, and how much is that? Rabbi Ami Omar, Rabbi Yochanan, Rav Ami quotes Rabbi Yochanan saying, Arba, and here we have a discrepancy or difference in terms of version. The Vilna Goin quotes a girsa that speaks in terms of kavin, four kavin. The printed girsa is four sa'ah, lakur. So the kedei nefila would be per kur. These are measures. So per kur, and the Gemara itself will explain what do you mean per kur, but we'll hold off on that for a moment. Four kav of seed per kur would warrant the worker continuing his efforts. Rav Ami delay, Omar Rav Ami himself, prior to this Rav Ami quote Rabbi Yochanan, here Rav Ami delay. Rav Ami himself says, Shmoinis Soin or Kavin Lakur. Omar Le Hahu Sabo Rav Chama Brei the Rabo Baravua. So a certain Saba, a certain old man. There are other explanations you can find in other places in the Shasan. Hahu Saba, but we'll say a certain old man said to Rav Chama, Azbroloch, I will explain to you. In other words, that Rav Ami and Rav Yochanan aren't really arguing with one another, but their different quantities are a reflection of different times in we'll say, in history. B'shnei means in the years of, b'shonim shel, so the word in the construct form is b'shnei. B'shnei to Rabbi Yochanan, in the years of Rabbi Yochanan, have shmeina ara. The land was rich, so that four kav of seed would be enough. And b'shnei to Rabbi Ami, have kisha ara. The land was poor in quality, and therefore, in order to plant a kur of ground, you would need eight kav. You would need twice the amount. So, We mentioned before kedei kur, so we can see now a little more clearly that the seed quantities are enough seed, either four sa'ah or kav or eight sa'ah of seed, to plant an area of ground that measures a base kur. If you're going to ask how wide, how expansive an area is a base kur, so Rashi tells you that it would measure 1,500 amos by 50 amos, and you can make that into that. That dimension would be rectangular. The shape is irrelevant. It's a square area measuring 1,500 by 50. That square area would be the area that we're describing. Enough seed to replant that area of ground. If the field currently produces that small amount of grain, either four kav per kor or eight kav per kor, that would warrant the worker to continue cultivating it, because that amount is considered enough seed to replant that area. I just hope it's clear that if a kur is currently producing four kav, it's a bad situation. But it's enough. It's the minimum amount of production that would require the oris to continue investing efforts in the field. Having produced that amount, so the hope is he'll replant that, and next year the field will produce a full crop. Tanan Hosam. This source is from Maseches Peah. And Peah is a Masechta that deals with tithes that are left from one's field for the poor. Amongst the different tithes that are left for the poor is something called leket. Leket is a situation that arises that when you're harvesting grains, and you would say you grab a handful of grains, and a couple stalks, one or two stalks, escape your hand, and when you cut the grains, those stalks that escape your hand are left for the poor, left in the field for the poor to come and gather. Now we have a situation where it says, let's say, Tanan Hosam, it's taught there in Maseches Peah, HaRuach Shepizra Es HaOmrin, a wind blew after a person harvested his field, and all the sheaves of grain were scattered, and they ended up covering the sheaves that were the leket, the sheaves that were to be left for the poor. And now we don't know how much leket is in that field, how much leket is of leket grain. Leket stalks are under the owner's omrim, the owner's grains that were scattered. So the source says, Omdin means an evaluation is made. The court goes to the field and it makes an evaluation. Kamo leket ruyo la'asois v'noisin laniyam. How much leket would ordinarily appear, be produced by such a field? What's the normal amount of leket that occurs in fields of that size? And that amount that they assess will be given to the poor. V'noisin laniyam. Rav Shmuel Omer, Noisein Laniyam Kedei Nefila. Rav Shmuel says there's no need for making an estimation. The amount is, we'll say, preset. It's called Kedei Nefila. That's how much you'll give to the poor. V'kama Kedei Nefila. And how much is that? Kiyosu Ravdimi Yomer Abelozer V'teimo Rav Yochanan Arboas Kaven Lekur. Four kav of grain per kor. Now, when we speak about a kor, boy Rabirmiah, likur zera, a likur tavua. Kur zera is a reference to an area of ground that would be the required size or the proper size of ground area in which you would plant a kur of seed. Now, a kur of seed, kur is a measure. We spoke earlier about a piece of ground that measures a base kur. When we speak about a piece of ground that measures a base kur, is that a reference to a piece of ground that a kur quantity of seed? You just have to imagine that a kur is a dry measure. Just imagine a container, a large box that has that's labeled holding a kur of seed. That amount of seed, when planted in the ground, it covers a certain amount of area. You take a box full, a kur full of seed, and spread it over the ground for planting purposes. That area that's covered is a base kur. In terms of a kur zera, zera means planting of seed. So enough ground into which one would plant a kur quantity of seed. Or, the kur tvua. That means an area of ground from which you would harvest a kur of tvua. In other words, from the sheaves of grain in the field, according to this possibility, the grain amount that this field produces would be able to fill up a box measuring a kur. Now, naturally, that would be a significantly smaller piece of ground. A smaller piece of ground, once you harvest the grain from that small piece of ground, the quantity of grain produced there would fill up a box measuring a kur. Now, if you say, like the first possibility, that it's a kur, the base kur is an area in which you would plant a kur of seed, l'mapolis yad or l'mapolis shvorim. Mapolis yad, we'll call it hand planting. Mapolis shvorim is shvorim are oxen. Oxen are attached to a cart or a device that rolls along, maybe on wheels. It's drawn by the oxen, and the device has holes in it. And as the oxen are drawing this device, the seed falls into the ground. As we just mentioned, this cart has holes in it that, as the cart is being drawn by the oxen, seed falls into the ground. It may be obvious, and if not, we'll explain it anyway. There is a greater amount of seed that will fall through the holes than if you were to plant it by hand. So if you take a kur of zera, that's a kur, a box full of grain, we'll call it seeds, that measures a kur, if you're going to hand plant it, you're going to be covering a much larger area than if you plant it with the shvorim. So how much, what's the size of the kur that we are speaking of when you speak about how much leket do you give to the poor? So we saw the kedei nefila amount of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is the amount to replant a base kur. And so we explained already, what does that, we already raised the issue of, is it a reference to the amount of seed required to plant an area, or the area that would be planted by a kur of seed, or is it an area of ground from which you would harvest that amount of grain that would fill up a measure of a kur. So in order to resolve this, Toshma, Dechi, also Rovin, Omer, Rabbi Avuah, Omer Rabbi Elazar, the Amri Law, Omer Rabbi Yochanan. Some versions have Rabbi Elazar responding, some versions have Rabbi Yochanan. Very similar, by the way, to the explanation of what Kedei Mefilo is. We met Rav Dimi said in the name of Rabbi Elazar, and some versions had in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. So in responding to how do we measure the base core, they answered either Rabbi Elazar or Rabbi Yochanan, Arboas Kavin Lekur Zera. It's 4 kav per an area that would be planted by a core of seed. Vadayan Tiboilach, but the question still remains, okay, it's an area that in which you would be able to plant a core of seed. Is it Lamapoilis Yad or Lamapoilis Shvarim? Is it hand planting or ox cart planting? Teku. That remains unresolved. But after all is said and done, we have at least some picture of what Rav Shimon Leal was referring to in determining how much do we return or provide to the poor after the wind blew the grains covering the field. How much do we give to the poor? So he said, you will give to them 4 kav per core. Per core as the amount of area that you would be able to plant a core of seed in. So given that amount of ground, if you have several areas of that, so for each base core, you would give the poor 4 kav of grain. Before we go further, we glance at the side under the Nosei, the topic heading. Hefsedim Lasada Shaboba Ikvois Makas Medina. Losses to a field that come as a result of what we call Makas Medina, and we'll call it literally a public affliction, something that's not unique to that particular field, but the entire area was afflicted. So that situation results in poitrinus achoikir mechovo. It relieves the chocher from having to provide the pre-agreed amount that he had agreed to pay the owner of the field who gave him, the chocher, the right to work on it. This, Rashi points out, is another Mishnah that has relevance only to the chocher, because if you were talking in terms of a kablon where there's a percentage division between owner and worker, then there's no issue of subtracting from what the owner gets. They split the percentage, whatever percentage results from that field. If it's a lot, so they get a lot. If it's a little, so it's the same percentage. So that the issue of a field afflicted by a Makas Medina wouldn't change matters with regard to the Oris or Kablon. But with regard to the Chocher, who promised to pay a fixed amount in exchange for being able to work someone's field, in the event that that field isn't going to yield anything for the worker, so then there is reason for the worker to be able to reduce, to subtract from the amount that he originally agreed to pay the owner. The Mishnah. Hamakabel Soda Mechavero. Someone receives a field from an owner to cultivate it. The Ochla Hagav Oi Nishtafa, and the crop was consumed by locusts or experience Shidafon, which in English sometimes is translated as crop blast, but it's we'll say crop disease that ruins the crop. Imakas Medina Himanakalo Minchikuro. If we can identify and describe the situation as a public affliction, then the worker can subtract from the amount that he promised to pay the owner, from the fixed amount, the objective amount that he agreed to pay the owner. Im eino makas medina, ein menaka lo min chikuro. If it's not a public affliction, something of a private nature, then he doesn't subtract, where the owner has a claim against the worker and says it's your bad luck that caused the loss. And your bad luck is not reason for you to subtract from the pre-agreed promised amount that you're going to pay me. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Im kibla himeno b'mois bein kach u'bein kach eino menake lo min chikuro. If the agreement was one of a cash payment to be made, where the worker would pay cash, then even if you're dealing with a makas medina, there would be no subtraction, because the cash is not, we'll say, affected by the makas medina. Now we turn to the Gemara. Before, however, let us look at the Nosei heading. Number one, Hechi Domi Makas Medina. We will be asking what is meant by Makas Medina. Hagemara Tish'al, number two, Hagemara Tish'al, Sidra Shel She'elos, Aliba De'ula, the Gemara will ask a series of questions according to Ula, the Makas Medina Hainu Bizman Shebenaisaf Lesodesh Hu Oivibo, Nishtad Fugam Arba Hasodesh Shesuivo. Ula's definition is that in addition to the field that the worker is cultivating that has been afflicted, four surrounding fields likewise have become afflicted. But of course, before we can get into the Gemara, we must learn the Mishnah. Amakabil soda mechavero. That's a mistake we learned earlier. We did the Mishnah already. Now let's get into the Gemara with our introduction in mind. Hechi domi makas medina. The Mishnah had mentioned that if the affliction of the locusts or the crop blast was a makas medina, then the worker can subtract from the predetermined amount that he would pay the owner. So what are the guidelines or the circumstances that would define the affliction as a makas medina? Omar Rav Yehuda, kagon de ishdof ruba debago. Ishdof is like the word shidofon, which we referred to a crop blast, a crop ailment. And according to Rav Yehuda, it would have to have affected the majority of the baga. Baga is translated sometimes as a bika, a valley, or a, we'll say it, an agricultural region. So the majority of that agricultural region has been afflicted. Ula, a second approach, Omar, kegoin she nishtadfu arba sodos me arba ruchoisel. Four surrounding fields, four fields on the four sides of the field in question that our worker is working and now desirous of a relaxation in the amount that he should pay. So in addition to that field being affected, four surrounding fields as well were affected. That constitutes, according to Ula, what the Mishnah means as a makas medina. Omar Ula. Ba'u b'marava. Ula tells us that in Eretz Yisrael, they asked, they raised the following. And we'll see now a series of questions. And in order to appreciate these questions, Rashi's commentary will be very helpful. So, the first question. Nishdaf telem echod al pene kula mai. We spoke about crop blast on four fields surrounding the field in question. What would be if four telem? Telem is a furrow that's produced by a plow running through a field. Here we have four telems, four furrows that surround the field, and the crops growing on, we'll say, on those telems were affected. So does that constitute the four sides that Ula spoke of as being Makas Medina? We look in Rashi, and he says, Telem, or I should, Nishtav Telem Echad, Velo Yoiser, just one crop furrow, and not more, Misodus Shehen Svivasa, of the surrounding fields. Velo Telem, Kol Svivo Sodazu, and that particular furrow runs around all four sides of our field, the field that's in question. Does that represent a Makas Medina? Or do you say it has to be four complete fields that were affected surrounding our field? Number Bays. Let us say that four fields, four complete fields almost, surrounding our field was affected by crop blast. However, Nishtayer Telem Echad Alpene Kulomahu. The four surrounding fields were affected, with the exception of one furrow from each field that is immediately adjacent to our field that has suffered. Now, by the fact that you have that one furrow immediately adjacent to our field that was unaffected, maybe that constitutes a hefsik and a block, and therefore it doesn't fulfill the definition of Makas Medina, and rather it's the worker's bad luck. Or do we say that the fact that that one furrow remained cultivated and with crops on it is not considered significant enough positive field to represent a hefsek, an interposition between the field in question and the surrounding fields that were also affected. Now, another question. If sika bira mai. The word bira is similar to the word bor meaning something that was not cultivated. So let us say you have our field in question that's been affected by crop disease. Four surrounding fields have also, there are four surrounding fields. And those four surrounding fields were left uncultivated. They're buros. And fields beyond those four surrounding fields were affected by crop blast. Do we say that the four surrounding fields, immediate surrounding fields, they were not affected by crop blast? They were left uncultivated, so we can simply say that they were not affected by crop blast. And therefore, the central field, our field that's in question, is not the victim of Makas Medina. Or maybe the worker can argue to the owner, listen, those four surrounding fields, had they been cultivated, nothing would have grown because of crop disease. And therefore, even though they were not cultivated, they're as if they were and suffered from crop disease, and therefore I have a right to reduce the amount that I'm giving you. A fourth question. Aspasto, the Gemara continues at the top of Daf Kuvav, Mai. A fifth question. Zera Acher Mai. Let's go over these. Rashi, at the bottom line, Aspasta, Hayu Oison Shesvivosel, the fields that were surrounding our afflicted field, Zros Shachas, they were planted with Shachas. What Shachas? Shachas is, we'll say, growth designed for animal consumption. That's Lamaichel Behema. Velo Nishtefu. And the Shachas was not affected by the crop disease. But beyond those immediate fields that were planted with shachas and not affected were other fields that had been affected by crop disease. So we have our central field affected by crop disease. The immediate surrounding fields were planted shachas and were not affected. And the fields beyond them were affected. So does the shachas, do the shachas fields that are immediately surrounding our field, do they constitute a hefsik, a block? And if they do, so then we can't classify our field in question as the victim of Makas Medina. If you say that shachas does not constitute a hefsik, so then the field in question is the victim of Makas Medina, and the worker would be entitled to reduce the amount he has to pay the owner. The question, the fifth question, the hey question, Zera Acher Mai, we take a look at the Rashi on the second line from the top. Zera Acher Mai, Im Timtzalomar Aspasto Lav Hafsokahi. If you say that the case involving the Aspasto, that we said was the Shachas, that does not constitute a hefsik. Mishum delav bichlal gzeros puronos hatvuahu. Because it's not something that was included in the, we'll say, the heavenly affliction of the tvua. The omar le ilu tvua havoi iunami ishtaduf. The owner, the worker could say that if it had been left to develop into full grains, shachas is really the reference to grains that are not left to develop to full development, and they're harvested early and given to animals as animal feed. However, had it been allowed to grow into full grains, they would have also suffered from crop blast. So this question of Zera Acher is coming on the heels of an assumption that if you say that the Aspasto doesn't constitute a Hefsik, Zera Acher mihavi Hafsoka. What does Zera Acher mean? If the central field was planted with one variety of crop and the surrounding fields were planted with another variety of crop, and beyond that were fields that were affected by shidafon, by crop blast, do we say that the zera acher constitutes a hefsik? If you would assume for a moment that zera acher would constitute a hafsoka, a block, so that if you had a wheat field, the field that's in question is a wheat field, and it's been affected by crop disease. And surrounding the wheat field are fields in which they are growing tomatoes. And beyond the tomato fields are again wheat fields that were afflicted by crop disease. If you take the approach that, well, tomatoes, that's zera acher, and that constitutes a block, and therefore it's not a Makas Medina. In other words, we can't view the central field as being the victim of Makas Medina. What about this case? Chiti legabi soirim kizera acher domi oiloi. Let us say the central field is wheat, and the surrounding fields they're not tomato fields, but rather barley. The barley is very similar in many respects to wheat, but it's not the same thing. And you have surrounding barley fields, and beyond that, more wheat fields. Do we say that the surrounding barley fields are like Zera Acher? Olo, or maybe not. It appears to me, in analyzing the case of Zera Acher, whether or not that we referred to the tomato example as separating between the internal wheat field and the other wheat fields that are beyond the internal, beyond the tomatoes. We also pointed out that all the wheat fields were affected. The question is, what if the internal wheat field is surrounded by tomatoes? Does that constitute a block, a separation between the internal field and the surrounding fields that, if you consider it a block, regardless of the condition of the tomatoes, but you simply, because it's Zerach, it's considered a block, so the internal field would not be the victim of Makas Medina. If you say that it's not a block, so then it would be considered Makas Medina. And now, as the Gemara went on regarding Chiti Legabi Soirim, do we view the barley that is the immediate type of grain surrounding the internal wheat field as Zera Acher or not? If it's viewed as Zera Acher, so then the internal wheat field is separated from the other wheat fields that were likewise affected, and it would not be Makas Medina. If you say that Sorim are so similar to Chitim, and I think you have to assume then that in that the Sorim were also affected by crop disease, if you say it's not like Zera Acher, so then you would have a case of Makas Medina. If, however, the barley is viewed as Zera Acher, even though it was affected by crop disease, it would be a Hefsik on the grounds that it's called Zera Acher, a different kind of species. So that question is presented. How do you view barley in relation to wheat? Another series of questions. Kol olam kulo b'shidofon v'shelo b'yerokon. The terms shidofon and yerokon are different types of crop disease. So imagine all of the surrounding area was affected by one type of crop disease, and the field in question was affected by yerokon, another kind of crop disease. Inami, kol olam kulo b'yerokon, were the other way around. All of the surrounding fields were affected by yerokon v'shelo b'shidofon, and the field in question was affected by shidofon. Again, different from that which the rest of the world was afflicted with. My, how do we judge that? Teku. This remains unresolved. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.